This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. You're listening to an interview with Elliot Grossman, attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I wanted to get your comments on how you see the movement to win Mumia justice, the protest movement that has emerged over the last decade, how this plays in part with winning Mumia's freedom.
Well,
in addition to all this new evidence that's coming forward.
Well, I think that what we have now, you know, Mumia has always said that he was innocent. And the basic orientation of the political movement has been to say that he was framed. Now we actually have the evidence to prove it,
right,
to prove what happened, to prove that he is innocent, to prove that he was framed. And I think what we need to do is we need to go forward strongly with this evidence and get the word out. And part of the reason that it's important to get the word out and to show a very strong and visible presence is that the prosecution has also lied all the way through this case, consciously lied that there was nobody at the scene when this occurred except for Faulkner himself and Mumia and Billy Cook. In fact, there were several after-hour clubs right at this intersection, and it was just at the time when people were leaving the clubs. There were probably hundreds of people in the area when this took place. And there's numerous witnesses who actually saw what happened, but who have been afraid to come forward up until this point. We're sure there are probably witnesses out there that we don't even know about. There are written witness statements from witnesses that no one's ever been able to locate.
Right.
If now that this information is out, and now that Arnold Beverly has actually come forward and taken responsibility himself for what he's done, we're hoping that other people who saw what happened and weren't involved but were still afraid to come forward because of, you know, the
obvious police corruption,
obvious, you know, problems there, will now be emboldened to come forward and testify also. And I think it's very important that that this get out and that the demand that Mumia be freed immediately go forward, because this man is not only awaiting execution, 20 years have been taken from his life.
Yeah.
He's been in prison for 20 years, and he's innocent, and he should be freed.
He should be freed.
He should be freed. That's our position, is that he should be freed. And if after all of this, the prosecution decides they're still going to go ahead and retry him on all this fabricated evidence, you know, that's their decision to make, and we'll fight that every inch of the way. But our position is the evidence is fabricated, the man didn't do it, he should be free.
Now,
if there's any investigation to take place, there should be an investigation of the Philadelphia Police Department and the prosecution.
This case is basically in its final appeals process, is that right? I mean, could you explain the legal situation where it stands now?
Yes. The way the legal situation is, you know, we should probably, like, recapitulate. There was a trial. There was a direct appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. That was denied. There was then what is called, in 1995, post-conviction hearings in front of Judge Sabo, who was the original trial judge, and Judge Sabo ruled against Mumia. There was then an appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and they ruled against Mumia. Now, we have filed a petition. Well, we haven't filed it. It was originally filed by the prior attorneys, but there is filed in the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which is basically going to the federal court system and saying that Mumia's federal constitutional rights were violated in the state court proceedings, and that the federal courts should now look into this and throw out his conviction and throw out his death sentence. So this is now set before Judge Yon in the federal court for that purpose. And what we are waiting is for those proceedings to go forward. We're in the process of, you know, we've just come onto the case, so we're going through the files, we're conducting our own investigation. We expect to have other evidence to present when the evidence is found and sufficiently corroborated. And then there should be a hearing in the federal court on the evidence and on the habeas corpus petition. And if the judge, we believe what the judge should do once that takes place is based upon everything that we've got, even now, and certainly on what we expect to have in the future, the judge has the power to quash or throw out the conviction and death sentence and to order that Mumia be released.
Immediately.
Yes, he can order his immediate release, and then it's up to the state of Pennsylvania to decide what they're going to do.
So if the judge does order Mumia released, then the state can, again, refile charges. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, the state has the right, if they wish to do so, to proceed and file charges again and persist in their 20-year effort to frame an innocent man. And that's another reason why we believe that the movement around Mumia's case, you know, the political movement around his case, is important so that it will be made very clear to the district attorney's office that not only people around the world and around the country, but that the people of the city of Philadelphia do not want this frame-up to continue, because the district attorneys are supposed to be public servants. They're supposed to represent the public. And I think that once it's made very clear that the public are tired of an innocent man being prosecuted, that will be significant. Now, if for some reason the judge should rule against Mumia, and given, you know, the evidence, it's hard to imagine that something like that would happen, the next step would be to, the judge would have to certify, basically, that an appeal could be taken to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And if the judge didn't do that, then we would have to go to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals through another procedure and basically ask permission to file an appeal with them.
We've been speaking with Elliot Lee Grossman, Los Angeles attorney now, representation, legal team for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That interview was from Vinny at Free Radio Santa Cruz in California, which, by the way, is an unlicensed and therefore illegal radio station. So the broadcast you just heard was a criminal act. Free Radio Santa Cruz has been on the air for more than 4 years, is all volunteer, and was started by a group of street kids. The FCC has attempted to raid the station and shut them down several times, but they have successfully escaped and started up from a new location. They now produce a weekly newscast as well. Free Radio Santa Cruz can't get a license to broadcast. A station that airs a guy called Bubba the Love Sponge, who tortures and kills animals live on the air, can. Someone is surprised that respect for law and authority are declining? One benchmark for the declining level of confidence in our criminal justice system is the rising tide of protest against the death penalty. Opponents of the death penalty have for years made the issue a moral one, without substantially affecting public opinion. The new movement for abolition is gaining adherence based on the injustice of the legal system and its propensity to convict and sentence innocent people. Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matter spoke with Robert Mirapol of the Rosenberg Fund for Children about the death penalty.
We are lucky to have Robert Mirapol, who is the youngest son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and who is the founder and executive director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children. Robert, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start out. Let me ask you, who are Julius and Ethel Rosenberg?
Well, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were my parents. They were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage in 1950. They were arrested in 1950 in New York City and executed by the federal government after being convicted of this charge on June 19th, 1953, when I was 6 years old. Even though the charge was conspiracy, the crime was characterized as stealing the secret of the atomic bomb and giving it to the Soviet Union, and that was used to justify the death sentence against them.
So I have to imagine that that dramatically shaped your views on capital punishment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because as a child, I grew up believing that one might wonder why my name is Robert Mirapol. First of all, I was adopted by Abel and Ann Mirapol when I was six, and my name was changed to Mirapol. And by the time I was old enough to change it back, it was who I was, and that's so I've remained that to this day. From the time I was a small child, I believed that my parents had been framed, that they did not commit the crime that they were killed for, and that the government knew it. And so I actually viewed them as murder victims. So as a teenager, I believed in capital punishment. I wanted to have capital punishment for the people who killed my parents. And it is only as I've gotten older, and rethought this and come to terms with what capital punishment actually means and the institution of capital punishment, that I have come to the conclusion that capital punishment is just wrong, that I would not even advocate capital punishment for the people who are responsible for killing my parents.
Now, is this, I'm guessing that this view of yours happened over time and wasn't like a single incident that shaped that.
And no, you're right. It's I also rather late in life, or relatively late in life, in my early 30s, I went to law school and became an attorney. And then I ended up as, I guess you could say, my brother and I are the only two people in American history who've had both their parents executed by the government. And you put that, you add to that I'm an attorney. I imagine there are very few, if any, attorneys, perhaps anywhere in the world, who've had their parents executed. And of course, I don't know this for a fact, but I think it's a pretty safe guess. Well, that raises the question of capital punishment in front of me. It's inescapable. And the more I thought about it, and the more I ended up being connected to people who were involved in this issue, the more abhorrent it became to me. So that developed over time. And I think it's also been in the last 5 years that there's been an explosion of interest about this issue. So it's not only that I have a position on it, it's that more and more people seem to want to hear that position.
And why do you feel there's been this explosion of interest?
Well, I think it's very difficult to figure out what's at the core of it. I know that as early as the mid-1990s, there were some surveys done, one by Rolling Stone magazine, of college campuses, in which students were asked to list the things, the hottest topics, the things that mattered to them the most, and capital punishment was way up there at the top of the list. And as is often the case, where students and young people start the trends of society, and then it gets picked up. I think there's another more sort of down-to-earth reason that there's been an increase in interest in this question, and that is that there have been more executions. That as there have been more executions, people have begun to wonder, is this the way we want to go? And there's also been a change in tactics or strategy of those who've been working against capital punishment. You could say, really, that since, well, as early as the Revolutionary War, there's been an anti-capital punishment movement in this country. Really, it was Quakers during the Revolutionary War articulated this position. But this position, up until really the last decade, has been dominated by religious or ethical thought. The position, the view that just capital punishment is morally wrong. It's wrong for us to take life in this manner. Well, I agree with that. I just think it's morally wrong also, but I don't think that's a very effective strategy, because the problem with taking a position based on a moral absolute is that someone else is going to feel just as strongly on the other side. And there's this kind of thing is not susceptible to rational persuasion. You're not going to convince people, no matter how long you argue with them. And so there it remained, sort of a stagnant debate, until in the 1990s, people began to articulate another position that was not based on morality. And it really was a very simple argument. I call it the perfection argument. And what I mean by that is that the problem with capital punishment is that it requires perfection. There's no room for error. You know, if you imprison somebody and later on evidence comes out that they didn't do the crime, you can't give them back the time they spent in prison, but you can release them. They can go on with their lives. You kill somebody and you discover that they weren't guilty. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't say, whoops, you can't bring them back. So the first part of the argument goes that capital punishment requires perfection. And the second part of the argument is that human beings are incapable of creating a perfect system. So if you put those two things together, both of which I think are undeniable, you end up with the inevitable result that innocent people will be executed. And I think anybody who really wants to look at this honestly and look at the hundreds of people who've been killed or executed since the reinstitution of capital punishment in the late 1970s, I think there's it's hard to maintain that you are certain that not a single person who was executed was innocent. And most people don't like that. They don't like that idea. So that argument, which has gained a lot of attention, particularly with the release of more and more people on death row, usually not through the intervention of the judicial system, but sometimes through the work of crusading journalists, as happened in Illinois. And the result has been that even people who are pro-capital punishment, or at least not morally against it, have said, we need a moratorium, as happened in the state of Illinois. A pro-capital punishment governor has declared a moratorium on executions in his state. And the same, the American Bar Association has asked for a national moratorium on capital punishment. Even some of the attorneys who aren't morally opposed to it have taken this position. So that has really fueled a massive revitalization of this movement. But it's not all, you know, it's not all good news. There are also challenges. And I would say at this juncture, with the date May 16th, Timothy McVeigh's execution date coming up very soon, someone like Timothy McVeigh, I believe, presents our biggest challenge. What I mean by that is that there are a lot of people who think they support capital punishment because they reason it out this way. They say, well, I support the execution of Timothy McVeigh, and therefore I support capital punishment. Our biggest challenge is to demonstrate to those people that they're making a fundamental mistake, and that fundamental mistake is to view capital punishment as a being about the execution of any particular individual, Timothy McVeigh included. That, you know, we don't live in a small village. We live in a mass society, over, 280 million people, the latest census. We don't have a law that says we are going to execute Timothy McVeigh or any particular individual. We have a class of crimes that are punishment and a class of punishments. And we have a massive government bureaucracy that is empowered to deal with this situation. And you can view it as, you know, the people who are talking about Timothy McVeigh are, you know, if you want to view it in a fishing analogy, it's like someone who's dropped has a fishing rod and is fishing for a trout or something, and they've dropped the line into the water and they're going to pick out this trout, this one Timothy McVeigh trout. But that's not really what capital punishment is about. It is what we have here is a dragnet that is dragging the bottom of the entire river. And you're going to sweep up in this net. It's not going to involve one case. It's going to involve hundreds, thousands, even tens of thousands of cases. And caught in that net, It's going to be the Timothy McVeighs. It's also going to be innocent people. And there's no way you can have one without the other. In order to execute Timothy McVeigh, to give the government that power to make that decision, you also have to create an institution which inevitably is going to lead to the execution of innocent people. And that's the biggest challenge we face, because maybe I'm just not very good at explaining it, but I have found that no matter how many times this is said, there is a segment of the population which just doesn't seem to get it, keeps on coming up with individual examples. What about this person? What about that person? And that, one way to try to cut through that is... When you have a situation like this, is to point out to people that the very same people who tend to support capital punishment also tend not to trust government. They don't like big government. They don't trust the government to come up with a fair tax system. They don't even trust the government to put up a traffic light in their neighborhood without making a mess of it. And these same people who don't trust that government and who scoff at the bureaucracy and think that they're inefficient and dishonest and corrupt, those are the same people, in many cases, who want to give that same government the power of life and death. And you say to them, you don't trust them to put up a traffic light, but you trust them to make sure that only innocent people are going to be executed, only guilty people are going to be executed. And that causes some of these folks to pause. And it is arguments like that that are moving people. And it's why there is a growing anti-capital punishment movement in America today.
Now, you spoke last night here in Seattle, and I gather that you've actually been pursuing this for quite a while. Have you seen larger crowds coming?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. I started publicly with public speaking in the mid-1970s when I was in my 20s, and that was what we called the effort to reopen our parents' case. My brother and I were involved in that. In the 80s, I was relatively quiet. I went back to law school, did a number of other things. But starting in 1990, when I founded the Rosenberg Fund for Children, ever since then, it's not like I'm on a college tour or a community group tour. I don't have the time for that. I might not be on more than half a dozen or eight campuses a year. We're based in Western Massachusetts, the Rosenberg Fund for Children is, and so it's a long way out here to Seattle. I don't get here too frequently. But during this past decade, one of the things I noticed pretty early on, but it picked up steam in the mid-1990s, was that if I was going to come to a college campus and I was billed as the younger son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, speaking about the Rosenberg case, which J. Edgar Hoover called the crime of the century, I'd get a certain number of people to come out. If the same amount of publicity was done by the same people and the same with the equal amount of or an equivalent amount of effectiveness, but instead of being billed as the younger son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg speaking on their case, I was billed as one of the only two people, along with my brother, to have both their parents executed by the government of the United States, and I was going to speak out on the issue of capital punishment, three times as many people would show up. And that wasn't the case in 1992, but by 1998, it was the case. And I think there's a myth that we need to dispel about what we need to accomplish in order to end capital punishment in the United States. People tend to look at the polls. They say, it's good. Used to be it was a 2-to-1 ratio in favor of capital punishment, and now it's 60-40. So we're moving in the right direction. And there's this idea that we have to get to the point where we have a 51% majority, and when we reach that point, then capital punishment will be abolished. It's not the case. There's this myth about the 1960s that the reason the war in Vietnam was ended was that the majority came to oppose it. Well, I was there, and I can tell you we were never a majority. We were at most a large minority. And when you have 40% of the population on your side, The key is not necessarily moving that 40% to 51%. The key is activating that 40%. When you're talking about 40% of 280 million people, if you get more and a larger percentage of your supporters to actually get actively engaged and working on things, that's the key, and that's the difference. It's not necessarily that a larger percentage of people are anti-capital punishment. It's that a larger number of those who are willing to be active. And of course, the other thing is that there's a 20 to 30% of those polls who are sort of fence sitters. They're not really strongly leaning one way or another. And if those who are anti-capital punishment become very active and very vocal, it tends to move the fence sitters. And those two things are both happening. And so I'm actually quite optimistic about it. The unfortunate part is that the rate of executions appear to be increasing, at least in some states. And I don't think we're going to abolish capital punishment this year or next year. And more people are going to be killed. But I believe that it is inevitable that come the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to win this battle.
What do you think of the prospect of Timothy McVeigh's execution being televised? That seems like a real step backwards.
Well, you know, it's a two-edged sword. My understanding is that the televising, which is on closed circuit, is that a majority of family members, victim family members, have actually chosen not to watch. That it's only a minority who want to watch this, and that's an interesting fact that I don't think has been brought out. But you know, there are those who have favored public executions, who are anti-capital punishment, because they feel that this will fuel the growing revulsion against capital punishment. But there are others who feel that, you know, the increasingly graphic reality television is actually fueling a more violent society. And, I mean, it's one of the problems with capital punishment. There tends to be a correlation between the level of violence and the amount of capital punishment. It's capital punishment, far from deterring, seems to actually stir people up. After all, the government, in the process of saying that killing is wrong, is actually carrying out killing. And you know, it doesn't take a great deal of intelligence to realize that there's a basic contradiction there. So the prospect of, I think that the whole Timothy McVeigh execution is stirring up the waters. It is making people consider this question, even as they think about his execution. And of course, in some ways, it's a tremendous challenge for us, because as I said before, he is one of the least sympathetic potential, you know, people about to be executed who I could imagine. At the same time, I am unaware of any execution that ever increased support for capital punishment. It seems to me that with each execution, there are a few more people who come over and say, we don't want to be part of this. You know, we are in a democracy. We live in a democracy. This is the federal death penalty. This isn't the state death penalty. In some ways, we all bear, however indirect, a share of responsibility for this execution. And there are, even this execution will move a certain segment of people who weren't there before to say, I don't want this happening in my name.
So what are the steps that you envision that are necessary to change our federal institution of capital punishment?
Well, I think we've got an awful lot of people on our side. And the trick is to do something. If everybody does something, whether it's write a letter, talk to a friend, make a connection with a death row inmate, participate in a demonstration. There are websites all over the place dealing with capital punishment. Good place to start is Amnesty International's website, or www.amnestyusa.org, I believe, is the start, and you can then find there's dozens of things to do. But the thing I want to point out is some people are daunted by the magnitude of the problem. And it's not necessary to try to take it on all by yourself. It's not necessary to try to do a lot. There are so many of us that what I want to urge people to do is to do something. And you can pick what that something is, because the more sort of background education rumbling that's going on around this, the better. And that will ultimately end it. I notice our time is short, and I don't want to skip over the Rosenberg Fund for Children. I do want to say that I went through my parents' arrest when I was 3 and their execution when I was 6. I went through a lot of rough times. There was a community of support that rallied to my aid and my brother's aid, and that community of support helped me survive. And the Rosenberg Fund for Children is really my way of paying back that community of support by developing a fund. It's a public foundation. We provide for the educational and emotional needs of children in this country whose parents have been targeted in the course of their progressive activities. And with the recent upsurge in youth activism, we've now expanded our program, though only for really young people, to include targeted activist youth as well. And given the events that have happened in Seattle over the last couple of years, there are potential beneficiaries of our fund within the listening range of the station, I'm sure of that, who don't know about us. And also, as a public foundation, we have to raise the money that we give away. So anybody who's interested in contacting us for any reason, there are two ways. I'll start with the website. I don't want to assume that everybody's online. www.rfc, that's Rosenberg Fund for Children. So it's www.rfc.org. And that will get you into our website, which is really pretty extensive. And you can even find application forms on that website. But if you want to use the old method, and I'm old enough so that I'm still perhaps more comfortable with that, you can always contact us at Rosenberg Fund for Children, 1145 Main Street, Suite 408. That's 1145 Main Street, Suite 408, Springfield, Massachusetts. And the zip in Springfield, Massachusetts is 01103. So that's 1145 Main Street, Suite 408, Springfield, Massachusetts, 01103. And I can't say that I'll respond to any communication personally, but I might. But we do respond to our mail, and anybody interested in finding out more about us can contact us that way.
Very good. Well, I appreciate the fact that you brought up talking about people mm-hmm. coming forward and doing something. And I think one of the things that is so easy to slip into is the sense of isolation, that what we're doing is isolated. It doesn't seem to be connecting to anything else. And I think a lot of people will be surprised in how many others are working on this particular issue.
Well, and this issue is not happening in isolation either. The anti-capital punishment struggle is taking place within the context of larger struggles, or equally large struggles, against mass imprisonment in this country. I was at a conference, something called Critical Resistance, at Columbia University just at the beginning of March, where, you know, 3,000, they had 1,000 people they expected to come. 3,000 showed up. And almost all of them were young people, under 25. I was, you know, the people who looked like me there, they mostly were people who I knew, and we were few and far between. And while I was disappointed that I didn't see more of my age mates, I was actually very encouraged that there were so many people younger than me. A similar conference took place in Berkeley, California, also the Critical Resistance Movement, which is a movement against the prison industrial complex. That drew 3,000 to 4,000 people 2 years ago. So when you think about 3,000 to 4,000 people attending a conference, you know there's a dozen people at least who would like to come who can't, for every person who does attend. So you're talking about tens of thousands of people who are involved in this. And I think it's particularly important to keep the capital punishment struggle within the context of this broader anti-mass imprisonment struggle, because it will not be ending capital punishment, I see, as part of an understanding and a reevaluation of our nation's entire attitude towards imprisonment, our focus on retribution rather than reconciliation, and our idea that somehow if we lock all of those people away and we then surround ourselves with as much security as possible, that somehow we're going to have a better society, that somehow we're going to be freer. The more people we lock up, the less free we'll be. And the more we'll live in fear, and the more the divisions of society will become greater. And I think that has been demonstrated time and time again. And we have to figure out a way to get beyond that.
And as has been pointed out on this show numerous times, I mean, we're the country with the number one number of people in prisons, not a statistic that one should be proud of.
Yeah, 2 million people in prison is truly remarkable. The good side of that is you can't lock up that many people without sowing the seeds of a mass response, and I think that mass response has already begun.
Well, that's very inspiring to hear. We've only got a couple minutes left talking with Robert Mirpol, who is the youngest son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and founder and executive director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children. And last thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I do want to mention one particular case, probably the premier capital punishment case, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the journalist on death row in Pennsylvania. His case is before the federal courts, federal judge for the first time. It's been sitting there for over a year now. With the change in rules governing federal review, it's not clear whether the facts of his case will ever be independently explored. This is a critical moment, and we need people to monitor this case, to be aware of it, and actually to come out into the streets at critical points. And so I hope that people who are working to get a new trial for Mumia will not think, oh, nothing's going to happen, it's taking so long, that they will remain alert despite the fact that so much time has gone by, because we never can tell when the next shoe is going to drop.
Just speaking with Robert Mirpol, who's, again, is the youngest son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and founder and executive director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children.
And the interviewer was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle. The execution of convicted Oklahoma City bomber Tim McVeigh has been postponed. That interview was recorded last month. Faulkner, the Philly cop, was killed because he was an honest cop in the sense that he rejected payoffs. However, he, like most of his colleagues, engaged in casual brutality. Remember the testimony of Mumia's brother, that he was pulled over for no reason and was beaten by Faulkner for objecting to the harassment? Random stops, searches, and beatings are a common experience for black people. What is now shocking many is that white people who protest against the ruling institutions in this society are now beginning to get the same treatment meted out to people of color. It's not a matter of whether the protesters are violent or peaceful. It's about what they challenge. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the purpose of the military is to subjugate popular resistance in other countries to ensure that corporations can go in, loot the resources, and exploit the labor and make a big fat profit, selling you a bunch of junk you don't need. As long as you work, shop, and shut up, if you're white, you're all right. This article from the Associated Press illustrates that when you confront the heart of power, the deal's off. This was published on Thursday, May 24th, by the Associated Press, titled, George W. Bush's America. Judge sentences School of the Americas protesters to 6 months in prison. 88-year-old Catholic nun among those imprisoned by Elliot Miner. Columbus, Georgia. A U.S. magistrate on Wednesday sentenced peace activists to up to 6 months in prison for trespassing at Fort Benning last fall, to demand the closing of an army school that trains Latin American soldiers. The 26 defendants, ranging from a 19-year-old college student to an 88-year-old Catholic nun, were among the 3,400 protesters who marched into the military post November 19th to protest the School of the Americas. The protesters say graduates of the school have been linked to murder, torture, and other human rights abuses. Before the protests, the 26 defendants were notified that because they participated in previous intrusions, they would be prosecuted if arrested. Officials say the school's mission is to spread democratic principles among Latin American leaders who come there to study. U.S. Magistrate G. Mallon Faircloth said the defendants violated a law aimed at preserving good morale, order, and discipline on military bases. The law prohibits political gatherings on military property. "We are a government of the people," he said. "The majority in Congress enacted the law you are accused of breaking. You re-entered those premises in violation of the law. Therefore, it is my duty to impose sentences." One of the defendants pleaded guilty Monday. The judge found the rest guilty Wednesday. They had been charged with criminal trespassing. Faircloth initially sentenced 88-year-old Dorothy Hennessy, a Dubuque, Iowa nun, to 6 months probation. She said she didn't want any special treatment because of her age. Then the judge changed her sentence to 6 months in prison. He imposed a similar sentence on her sister Gwen Hennessy, a 68-year-old nun. Homemaker Mary Lou Benson, 56, of Brainerd, Minnesota, said she thought her 3-month sentence was harsh. "I feel like I was called to cross the line," she said. "In crossing, I was standing in solidarity with the oppressed of South America. Nobody thought the government would do this." Roy Bourgeois, founder of the group that has sponsored School of the Americas demonstrations since 1990, said the sentences were unfair. "This genteel Southern judge smiles, and then comes the dagger," Bourgeois said. "It baffles me how he can sleep at night when an 88-year-old nun is going to prison, when assassins and soldiers who have tortured and raped get pardons. A grave injustice has been done." The School of the Americas moved to Fort Benning from Panama in 1984. It closed last December and reopened in January with a new name, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Responsibility for the school has been transferred from the Army to the Department of Defense, and it has a new curriculum. Officials say the demonstration cost the Army about $50,000 for security cleanup and processing demonstrators who are arrested. The School of America Watch protesters who were sentenced Wednesday were David Corcoran, 67, Illinois, hospital chaplain, father of 3 adopted Korean children, sentence 6 months, $1,000 fine. Mary Lou Benson, 56, Minnesota, homemaker, married, mother of 4, sentence 6 months. Josh Raisler Cohn, 24, Oregon, social and environmental justice activist, sentence 6 months, $1,000 fine. Russell DeYoung, 54, Virginia, NASA senior research scientist, married, father of 2, sentence 6 months, $1,000 fine. John Ewers, 66, Ohio, retired manager at NCR Corporation, Habitat for Humanity volunteer, married, father of 4, sentence 6 months, $1,000 fine. Jack Gilroy, New York, high school teacher, married, father of 4, sentence 6 months, $500 fine. Claire Hanrahan, 52, North Carolina, freelance writer-journalist, gardener, mother of 1, sentence 6 months, $500 fine. Martha Hayward, 56, Michigan, middle school teacher, married, mother of 4, sentence 3 years probation, $3,000 fine. Rachel Louise Hayward, 19, Michigan, student, majoring in biology and Spanish, sentence 6 months. Dorothy M. Hennessy, 88, Iowa, Dubuque Franciscan peace worker, sentence 6 months. Gwen Hennessy, 68, Iowa, Dubuque Franciscan peace worker, sentence 6 months. Rita Hohenschel, 76, Iowa, retired, mother of 4, grandmother of 5, sentence 3 months. William Houston, 72, Ohio, retired professor, father of 2, sentence 6 months, $1,000 fine. John Alfred Hunt, North Carolina, community educator and activist, sentence 6 months, $500 fine. Steve Jacobs, Missouri, member of the St. Francis Catholic Worker, veteran, and folk singer, sentence 1 year. Rebecca Canner, 43, Michigan, environmental educator, UAW member, sentence 6 months, $500 fine. Joel Kilgore, 24, Minnesota, baker and cooperative bakery, member of Loaves and Fishes Catholic Worker, sentence 1 month. Richard John Kinane, 51, Colorado, teacher and contemplative psychotherapist, sentence 6 months, $500 fine. Elizabeth Ann McKenzie, 71, Minnesota, retired teacher, sister of St. Joseph, sentence 6 months. Carl Meyer, Tennessee, member of Nashville Greenland Community, activist with Catholic Worker Movement for 44 years, sentence 6 months. Lois Putzier, Arizona, union organizer, married, sentence 6 months. Eric Robinson, 21, Washington, social justice activist, sentence 6 months, $500 fine. Miriam Spencer, 75, Washington, member of Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace, actively retired, sentence 6 months. Catherine Temple, 28, North Carolina, artist, writer, feminist, sentence 2 years probation, $500 fine. Hazel Tulek, 77, Ohio, retired, mother of four, sentence 3 months. Mary Alice Vaughn, 68, Minnesota, retired elementary school teacher, former Sister of St. Joseph, sentence 6 months, $150 fine.
So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. Cause all that you have is your soul.
A meeting has been called for Monday, May 28th, Memorial Day, for social justice activists from Western New York. It will take place in Ithaca from noon to 4. People will meet at the Office of Catholic Charities at 324 West Buffalo Street, between Albany and Plain Streets, to brainstorm about how to link up existing networks and support one another's work locally and regionally. Most people in the Finger Lakes have a hard time imagining the police repression that urban areas, even small cities like Syracuse, routinely experience. The people of Canada, which was a more humane, less militarized society, were shocked by the level of police brutality they saw recently in Quebec City. The young man who is the subject of the article we're going to read next comes from a small town surrounded by farmland in Quebec province, an area not so different from ours, an area where people still believe that the police can't brutalize the citizenry with impunity.
Silenced by a Plastic Bullet by Tucker Gomberg, from the May 17th through 23rd, 2001 edition of the Canadian periodical Now. I'm sitting in Eric LaFerriere's basement apartment, and his cell phone is ringing. He looks at it to see who's calling. He doesn't answer. He cannot speak. Democracy is about the right to speak out, but our country is now responding to peaceful protesters with unprecedented clouds of toxic tear gas and a new form of repression, plastic bullets. The cop who fired at LaFerriere was no more than 20 feet away from him, near the wall surrounding the summit of the Americas in Quebec City. The bullet hammered into his throat, crushing his larynx, which contains the vocal cords, as well as the trachea, the thumb-thick windpipe that brings air into the lungs. He now has a steel plate in his throat and breathes through a small metal hole. He speaks in a faint whisper with difficulty, wincing at the pain from the 6-inch stainless steel pipe stuck in his throat. Every breath burns. It's like someone is grabbing me by the throat and trying to choke me. How could a cop do this to me? He asks angrily, holding up a white 4-inch piece of plastic, the very bullet that hit him. Here, take it. Knock it against your head lightly, he tells me. It's hard like a rock. That's what hit me squarely in the throat. It was traveling at 300 feet per second, and somehow I had the reflex to reach down and grab it and put it into my pocket. In the corner of his living room sits a table stacked with hospital supplies, packages of plastic tubing, and a machine to suck out the liquids that build up in his lungs. I can't go swimming or take a bath. I have a hole in my throat. I can't even make love. I can't get excited. I have to remain calm. As the Summit of the Americas story moved from the front page, one story stuck in my mind. A man who was shot in the throat by a plastic bullet. What happened to him? National Democratic Party MP Sven Robinson's office sends me an article about La Ferrière, and I search the Quebec City daily newspaper Le Soleil for info. I call one of the journalists who has been writing about the use of plastic bullets, and from him I get the number of Eric's hospital room. I call repeatedly over many days, but there's no answer. I learn that he has left the hospital. One of the articles mentions the town he lives in, Sainte-Claire-le-Bellechasse. I scan the 600-plus La Ferrières in the province listed at Canada411.ca, but none matches the town, no leads. I then search the town name and have just one hit, a company that makes tractor bodies. The person who answers tells me that Eric used to work at the foundry in town and gives me that number. The receptionist is friendly, but company policy dictates that she cannot give me his number. She's happy to deliver my messages to Eric, though, who agrees to what turns out to be a 3-hour interview. I walk through the still graffitied streets of Quebec City and then hop a boat across the wide mouth of the St. Lawrence River to Lévis. A local bus and a taxi carry me 45 kilometers, first through the globalized landscape of Tim Hortons and 99-cent Junior Whoppers, and then past rolling fields of corn and hay. I'm left on a quiet street in front of a fourplex. Down the stairs, I'm welcomed into Eric's home, where he lives alone, the sunlit walls decorated with small paintings he did as a child. He's proud of his youthful talent and shows me a 20-year-old clipping from a Latouk newspaper that recognized his childhood skill. Later, we leaf through the piles of recent clippings. This time, he's front page with a bullet. The summit was barely a month ago, but so much has changed for La Ferrière since he heard on the news that 25,000 people were expected for a march in Quebec City. It was a beautiful day, and I wanted to be part of something large like that, a once-in-a-lifetime experience, he says. My mother saw me leave home that morning, and all I had was swimming goggles, a spare bandana, and a bottle of water. I am not a Hell's Angel. I am not violent. I am no dossier. I am clean. On Saturday afternoon, he stood alongside other protesters on Boulevard René Lévesque, some 20 feet from a double or triple row of fully decked-out riot police. Nothing much was happening. It was calm. Then, all of a sudden, clack, 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 the cops started firing tear gas canisters at the protesters. There was absolutely no reason for the cops to start firing tear gas, he said. The gas was so thick he couldn't see the person next to him. Some people ran, others got angry. He mimed his outrage. I went like this, he explains, first the middle finger, then a finger pointed at his head. F you, what you are doing is crazy, he was saying, but without words. Suddenly, he was doubled over in pain on the ground. My hand no longer worked. What did they do to me? I didn't know what hit me. Without thinking, he grabbed an empty tear gas canister that was lying nearby and was about to pitch it at the cops. It never left his hand. I tried to speak, but nothing came out. There was blood streaming out of his mouth, gobs of blood. People around him were panicking. Others shouted for a medic. The Red Cross called for an ambulance. La Ferrière could barely breathe. Before the ambulance arrived, police fired more tear gas in their vicinity. They had to evacuate him. The ambulance was directed to a different location, and from there, La Ferrière was rushed to the hospital. Since then, he's been bawling, bawling like a baby. Who fired this shot? And will he face the music? For attempted murder, a person should get 15 years, La Ferrière tells me. After caring for him for weeks, one of La Ferrière's nurses, Sylvie, confessed to him that her husband is a cop and that he was on duty during the summit. After a couple of minutes of silence, La Ferrière asked, "Did I deserve that bullet?" Lawyers have been hovering, offering to help him pro bono. They know I will win and that they will make money, he says. But he's not rushing into a legal battle just yet. I am not just going to charge the Quebec police or the RCMP. I'm going after the cop who shot me. I want to see the cop who shot me in front of me. For now, he drives. In the last few days, he traveled 1,200 kilometers. Next month, he'll go under the knife again. But if all goes well, he'll go traveling. There are so many things to see across Canada, he says. The CN Tower in Toronto, right? Where is Niagara Falls? They succeeded in crushing Eric LaFerriere's voice. Will you use yours to speak out against the chemical and military attack against peaceful protesters? That was Silence by a Plastic Bullet by Tucker Gomberg from the May 17th to 23rd, 2001 edition of the Canadian periodical Now. Have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Be my end for my guns and my